This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA FM and Pacifica Syndication. The great Irish novelist and playwright Edna O'Brien died at the age of 93 on July 27, 2024, after a long illness. A controversial figure from the start, her first novel from 1960, The Country Girls, which dealt with sexual and social issues in Ireland following World War II, was banned in Ireland and denounced on the pulpit. And while she moved to London with her husband before publication, she never moved back to her native land. Of Edna O'Brien from Wikipedia, the novelist Andrew O'Hagan wrote, "She changed the nature of Irish fiction. She brought the woman's perspective and sex and internal lives of those people to the page, and she did it with style, and she made those concerns international." In her lifetime, Edna O'Brien wrote 17 novels, several plays, 8 short story collections, 8 works of nonfiction, 4 children's books, and a collection of poems. I interviewed Edna O'Brien in the KPFA studios on April 28, 2000, while she was on tour for her novel, Wild Decembers, the third in a thematic trilogy of novels set in Ireland in the very recent past. It was later made into a television movie in 2008. This interview was digitized, remastered, and edited in August 2024 and is heard for the first time in its entirety. Wild Decembers is the third volume of a trilogy, the first two books of which are House of Splendid Isolation and Down by the River. And this is a trilogy about Ireland today. I'd like to start by asking you how you feel Wild Decembers ties up what you were trying to say about Ireland as a whole.
Well, that's a big question. Why it is relevant, or why I wanted to write it, is that the passion for land, the fear of being dispossessed in a land that was possessed or conquered. I mean, that's the sort of big answer. That is very strong and very potent. I also can assure you that up and down the country in Ireland, week after week and day after day, people have battles over bits of land, bits of road, gateways. And what it represents is not just an economic fear. It is something deeper. It's ancestral. And it is as if the bit of ground, or as I say in the book, fields that mean more than fields, more than life, and more than death too. So I hope that half answers your question.
Well, the three books are all about conflict. I mean, every novel in its own way is about conflict, but House of Splendid Isolation deals with the conflict, the Irish situation.
Yes, as it affects the South. The war between the North, between the six counties in England, but the dividedness that happened by the tragedy of a divided Ireland and how it affected the South, the North, and the South, their relationship.
And it's my understanding that Down by the River involves the religious end of it in terms of abortion.
Well, sexuality, covert sexuality, or incestuous sex, as it was in this, I suppose all sex is covert, come to think of it, or should be. It involves, it's both political and religious. There was a case in Ireland some time back in which the idea for Down by the River was so to speak, instigated or born in me, and it was a young girl who went to England to have an abortion, was recalled home by the Attorney General because she was underage, and her parents brought her home. And then the entire country, truly, literally, the entire country was up in arms, some saying she should be led back to England and others saying she should not. And what was interesting to me about it was that the girl, her plight and what had happened to her seemed to have been swallowed, well, put to one side almost, in the feud which happens going on in this country as well over that issue. But you can't write a novel just by reading a newspaper article, with all due respects. You have to, in some way, live it. I couldn't take a story from the outside, such as Wild Decembers, which I also took from the outside, unless it corresponded to something emotional and essential and visceral within myself. So the three stories, as I see them, one was about the war, the other is about religion and both civic and religious over the issue of abortion and whose life belongs to who. Wild Decembers, this one, is, to put it simply, is two men, Cain and Abel, and they are fight over a mountain, and a one woman, sister of one of the men, who herself is torn between her abiding affection for her brother and her burgeoning falling in love with her brother's enemy.
You mentioned Cain and Abel there, and I keep thinking that in all of these conflicts, there is an internecine battle. From looking from the outside, we see Irish.
I think the world is a battlefield, whether it's San Francisco or Ireland. By that I mean people are by nature, human beings are by nature full of conflict. People fight over men, over women, over jobs, over money, over land. I happen to set my books in Ireland because it's the only place I can. It's the only place I know, inside out and outside in. And you have to know everything about a place. Its history, its geography, its ghosts, its ancestry, its weather, its religion, its non-religion. You have to know everything and actually omit most of it. But you have to know it to feel on sure ground.
The book is obviously about individuals too, and I think that's what one of the things that distinguishes a novel from writing
journalism.
Oh, yes,
a story.
It's a story, and in this story, the individuals, Joseph and Bugler, in many ways are mirror images of one another, and this one woman who loves both of them. What brings them down, or what strikes me as bringing them all down, is something I've been thinking about a lot, which is pride and fear of slights. And I keep thinking about the human condition, and it seems that so many people act crazy because they think they've been slighted.
Yes. It's actually a deeper word than slighted, I would think, Richard. It's a fear of having their identity, their existence, and as you said, their pride or their sense of self taken away. And I don't think the men are mirror images of each other, to tell you the truth. Joseph represents the past and, if you like, a poetic dreaming. This is a man who dreams of Helen of Troy, blue seas and a romping woman. And yet he's a virgin. Bugler represents the future. He arrives on his tractor, heraldic and unflagging. It chugged up the mountain road, a new sound and a new machine. Bugler represents the future in terms of changing the pattern of the way of life, the way farming was done. So that is one thing. But he also is a sexual creature. So they are not mirror images of each other. They are two men who will inevitably fight over. But as regards the pride, what you say, it's a universal theme. It is easier, if anything is easy in this world, to write a novel or to set a story in a landscape where the landscape itself is very much part of the story and in a way conditions these people, the isolation, the loneliness. You could take the same story and set it in the city, in the stock exchange. Well, someone could. But it's the same theme in which everybody wants to be first. and everybody can't be first. And what we know in life and about stories, it alters. You know, do you know that song Frank Sinatra once sang, "Riding High in April, Shot Down in May"? That's true. And stories and the ins and outs and twists and turns, which I suppose Homer, more than any writer, writes about most fully. The way the gods and goddesses in Greek dramas suddenly decide that you, Richard, or I, Edna, will win today's battle, but tomorrow we're overthrown. And that's what makes story. And I am lucky that I can find stories in my own country and in my own part of my own country.
When you're working on a book such as Wild Decembers, and you're writing these characters, it occurred to me at the beginning of the book that Bugler may wind up being as full of hate, for instance, as Joseph. He doesn't. I mean, he in his own way tries to settle it, but moves on also. The question is, what happens when your characters begin behaving in a way that looks as if maybe they won't take the story where it needs to go? What do you do?
Well, you go with them. But also, there's just something I'd like to pick up on that you said. I don't think it is that Joseph is full of hate. He's full of fear. People who are afraid do very violent things. Fear is something that is I would think Joseph, the character I most thought of when I was writing it, and indeed reread some, was Captain Ahab in Moby Dick, for whom that whale eventually represented everything that was evil, dangerous, and overthrowing about life. For Joseph, Bugler's existence, Bugler turning the bog into cutting turf or deciding to grow cranberries or singing in a dance hall in a red bandit-style shirt or Bugler, whatever. Each moment and movement of Bugler's became for Joseph something unbearable. So hate isn't the word, fear is the word, but also when you ask me about characters and how they go, I think the most part, sort of secretly important ingredient for a writer, fiction writer or drama writer, is always to be mindful of the ambiguity within human beings. No one is just utterly bad or utterly good. And to have for her or him a compassion. It would be too easy and actually too cliche to write about the good man and the bad man. They're all poets in their own way.
Joseph is also a bit of a Greek scholar. Why did you do that?
Well, a lot of people I know in those lonely places, first of all, Irish people, or some of them anyhow, I'm glad to report, do actually love literature and story, and it would be quite credible. There wouldn't be many books in that house, but somehow there would be the Greek myths that he came on. And for him, as for many people, reading and finding all sorts of story and all sorts of excitement in distant books, not on their own doorstep, is a form of living. It's not voyeurism as such, but the excitement that stories like that bring to a man, they enrich his life. And he believes that he knew Helen and those blue seas. And I think Homer said they were wine dark seas, but there we are.
It's interesting that he focuses on Greek mythology, and yet his lawyer, O'Day, tells stories about Ireland that date back 500 years as if they were yesterday.
Well, there's a lot in common between Greek stories and Irish. That's the first thing. And O'Day, once he has a few drinks and won a case, as an aside, a friend of mine, a young solicitor in Ireland, or fairly young, I rang him up one day because I was getting help for this book. And I said, "How are you, Billy?" "Oh," he said, "I'm fine. I got one man in jail this morning and I'll maybe get another in." These solicitors are full of stories because they get the actual essential nub and pith of human life. They get everyone's story. They get the wills people have made. They get people who are fighting with each other. They get what they hope. And when they are out relaxing, if that is the right word, and have a few drinks, of course, they don't tell the secrets of their clients, the living ones, but they like to expound on the secrets of the dead ones. And you get that in Ireland. You get people, just everyone is full of stories. And also, they like to talk and have a few drinks.
When you say everyone's full of stories, I wonder if that's why Irish literature is as great as it is.
That would be one of the essential reasons. And the other is the love of language, because a story is fine. We know a story, but how to give it as to make it fresh, to make it like it was never heard before, that comes from the through the metier of the words. James Joyce said a wonderful thing once. He said a lot of wonderful things, as well as doing great things. He said, I have all the words. It's a question of knowing how to put them together.
He certainly put them together in orders no one else has before or since.
Absolutely. Yes. So that's for sure.
Edna O'Brien, there are several secondary characters in your book, Wild Decembers, and I'd like you to talk briefly about them. You have two sisters, Rita and Rena, and also a hair salon proprietress named Josephine, and a fourth character named the Croc.
Yeah.
And these characters, in their own way, serve not only their own function, but they also serve to make the conflict greater, particularly Croc and Josephine.
Oh, yes. I mean, a novel isn't just three people. A novel, as James Joyce, to mention him again, has proved, is a whole motley. It's a whole world. And they can't be put in for what is laughingly called local color. They are intrinsic in their mischief and in their envy and in their duplicity. They are intrinsic to the plot, because the moment Josephine in the salon, and I know you want me to say it, talk it briefly, but I'll try and be brief. The moment she sniffs that this girl, Breach, is in love because she wants something done with her hair, she goes through every house in the town and out the streets and up to the outer lanes, up to the country. And she immediately divines who it is. Now, this she conveys to the Croc. The Croc is a very interesting character, I think, because he seeds within as his own deformity and not only envies but rages against the possibility of lovers and sexual lovers, and is himself in his caravan a lost man. But he's very, he moves around and he stirs the story. As regards the two bawdy sisters, I think years ago, I saw this play of J.M. Singh's, which I love. I often see it, the play by the Western World. And there's a woman in it called the Widow Quinn. And the Widow Quinn is larger than life in her language and in her deeds. And although sometimes I'm accused of writing quite sad or violent, they've moved from sad to violent with me in the adjectives, I also like to write about what is funny and wild, and those two sisters are, they're demons or demonesses, but they're there to also try and grab land and seduce Bugler. Everyone, you see, it's like life. It's like you, I, everyone in this building. Everyone is looking for something. Everyone has a secret, a not-so-secret agenda. And in a novel, you're lucky that you can pool all that together and get it to its pitch, its absolute.
You were born in Ireland, moved to London, though your books still take place in Ireland. I wonder if you put yourself in that sense in the same place as Mick, who is returning to Ireland. He's still Australian, but he's returning there. And I wonder if you were to go back, if you would find the differences between yourself and the country you came from as great as those Mick Bugler found. Yeah.
No, not really, because I go back all the time. And As a matter of fact, when I was researching this book, I had to find a man who knew all about tractors. And he was a very handsome man. And I would nab him when he came out of Mass on Sundays, the only time I could get him. And he showed me tractors, told me this, that, and the other. But one day he said to his brother, he said, "Would you ask that woman, keep that woman away from me. I've told her everything I know about tractors." But no, it would be very different. Now, Bugler comes from Australia. He wasn't born in Ireland. He is enchanted by the place, and he finds when he has come that the sweetheart he left in Australia, or the girlfriend, or whatever we want to call her, the chick, the betrothed, his interest in her begins to fade because he finds what he had been looking for and things his mother had told him, and that he finds the essence or truth of these things in this place. I'm different because, naturally, well, I'm a woman as well. But although I left Ireland when there was a little bit of shenanigans over my first books, I am always going back there. So I don't feel that I have left there at all in terms of, you know, rummaging around, finding stories, walking these fields and roads. And I'm thankful for them. Because without them, I wouldn't have any stories.
The other major character whom we haven't discussed here is Breege, the young woman who is torn between her brother Joseph and her lover, Bugler. She, halfway through the book, loses it by becoming silent, which is a strange kind of way of going mad.
It's a strange way of going mad. Or certainly, I'm not sure that the doctor and her brother think she's mad, and as you know, have her put in Our Ladies, which is a highfalutin name for an asylum. She goes silent because if she speaks, she will tell her secret. Her secret being that despite the fact that she tried not to, she has fallen in love with this man. And she knows to her brother, or for her brother, that is a death knell. She also knows that it might even be a death knell for herself, because so fierce, so determined, and so umbilical is his love of his sister. Not an incestuous love, but a caring brother love. So she suddenly, as you know in the novel, Bugler, she sees him come into the hotel lounge where all good Catholics in Ireland go after Mass with his fiancée who has arrived. And she sees it. There it is, palpably. Him with the other woman. And she knows that the moment, or indeed the night that she had with him, has already had enormous consequences for her emotionally. So her one defense, and I wouldn't call it madness, I would call it terror.
The role of women seemed to, it's almost a throwback, that it doesn't feel as if it's today, though it is pretty much, you gloss over the actual time when it really happens.
It was the 70s.
The 70s.
Yeah, okay. When the tractors were.
The question then taken place afterward, or if more of feminism had arrived,
would the book be different? You know, I'm more interested in perennial passions, immediate or surface effect of could have happened. It would be a different brand of tractor, but the story would be as true for 20 years ago. A Breege is somebody who, in the fashionable world of our time, feels is not something that most women, if you ask them in the street and read them out part of what she says and her feelings, most women feel like that, and a lot of men feel like that. So you write a book and place it in a given time. But you also, or at least I also, would like that book, a book, to have a timelessness. And that is to do with the emotions and the passions rather than an imposed idea. Oh, now, because of the feminine movement, which has done marvelous things for women, let me be very clear about that, but because of that movement, that a person loves differently, no. They don't. That's tosh. And it's something that irritates me. Not you, but when it's suggested. So that I think the sisters are probably more spunky and more modern than the two wicked sisters, and they would fit into any dance hall in any situation. But Bridge is herself, I said a moment ago, and I still think it, I said that the three main characters are kind of poets in their own way. She's a kind of poet who is both living and witnessing her own life and theirs, and she'd be true, I hope, for any century, her feeling and her deepness.
I'd like to broaden the topic a little bit more to some of your other work as well. But one more question that as I was reading the book, I noticed about halfway through the book, Joseph almost disappears until the climax. But it struck me as I'm reading the book, he's the primary character for the first half of the book with a little bit toward Bugler and Brige. And then in the second half, it's almost all Brige and Bugler and Rosemary.
Yes, except behind it is the specter of Joseph's mounting paranoia and obsession, which she knows, although Bridge comes and her story, Joseph is there like the shadow who is going to, and it is building silently and brooding in him, because after he had tried to stop Bugler making a road, after he had spent all his money and some little savings Breach had and gone to solicitors to try and find papers, to look for papers in cardboard boxes, in dump rooms in this town or another, once you have done that, you know that there is going to be a climax or conclusion to that scenario, so that there is room, or I hope, for the other story and the passion between Bugler and Bridge to take front stage. It's like a play, in a way. You don't have Othello on stage the whole time. You have Desdemona and her maid, or you have whoever.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because I wanted to move into the area of plays and the difference for you between writing a play and writing a novel.
It's difference for anyone. It's a very different thing. In a novel, you can digress for 20, 30 pages and still keep the reader. Well, keep yourself first and then keep the reader. In a play, is confrontational throughout. And people often say, oh, you know, one of the important things for a play is the dialogue. The dialogue is secondary. The structure of a play, how it's structured, is the first important rule. And then the second is that a play has to, the battle between those characters is all the time being played out. So that it's a different part of the mind, almost, that would do one or the other. Chekhov, as we well know, and Samuel Beckett, they're the two examples that immediately come to my mind, who wrote dazzling and prose that will last forever. I've forgotten what that word is with my jet lag. And they wrote these great plays as well. But their themes, in a way, are the same. Chekhov's themes of people full of longing, entrapped in an isolation and a society. And Beckett's themes, I would say, I hope he's not listening in case I get it wrong, but Beckett's theme is the futility of life, which nevertheless is witnessed always between one character and another, and given to us or rendered through this extraordinary poetic language. But if you read Malone Dies and you see Waiting for Godot, you know that they're written by the same hand, but how he did them is completely different.
When you find a story and you know you're going to tell a story, what prompts you to choose turning it into a play or turning it into a novel or a short story?
It's kind of instinct, Richard. It's hard to, you don't, you know, I often think I'm like a sleepwalker who manages to write. That story, Wild Decembers, I might be so bold as to say I think it could be a film, because it's, but it wouldn't be a play on the stage. You can't have a tractor and fields. No, I'm joking. What prompts you is your own just blind and maybe not so blind instinct. I'll tell you as an aside, I don't know what time we had. I met somebody once who told me, do you know, he said, the day that man got married, he met a woman at his wedding and he started an affair with her and took another flat for her in the city in London. Now, to me, that was a short story. And I wrote a weird little short story called Number 10, which his wife in her sleepwalked every night to the place that he had taken for his mistress, but yet in daily life pretended she didn't do it. With a play, again, it's quite different. I just had a play produced at the Almeida Theatre in London in November, and that play is called Our Father. That is a family play where, and it's a day of an anniversary where everyone arrives, and you know, as that dog barks and the chapel bells ring and the dawn light comes up, that there is going to be extraordinary tension and interaction. Now, somebody said to me, why didn't you write Our Father as a novel? I couldn't, and I wouldn't have... you see, it's set in a room. It's set in a place, in a day. I wouldn't be able to have the things that I have in my novels, like the land and the elements. And in a novel, you're the director, actor, writer, stagehand, and six other things. With a play, you give the actors the story, the structure, the language, and the dynamic, and then they do a lot.
I interviewed playwright Arthur Lawrence not long ago, and I asked him point blank, have you ever had a character on stage who was the embodiment of the character that you saw in your head while you were writing the play? And he said, no, never, that's impossible.
I bet you Tennessee Williams would say that Marlon Brando was the embodiment of Stanley in Streetcar. I bet, well, to say I bet you, how do I know? But I think he was not only the embodiment, but also the enhancement of that. Yes, sometimes an actor can take something and surprise the author by giving it a greater urgency and a greater truth.
Have you experienced that?
Not fully. not fully. I have. I've forgot it. I was just now in Greece for a play of mine that I wrote about Virginia Woolf. And I was knocked out by how brilliantly they did it. But it was the whole thing. The set, the direction, actress who played it. She played it as I wanted it to be, like a kind of Greek tragedy. And that was, mind you, it was in Greek.
So you saw the emotion without necessarily hearing your words.
Yeah, I saw her power, and I saw that she had entered totally into the character.
There's something they teach at some of the schools and theater schools in New York, that it is not the words. The words are for the audience. What goes on the stage is the interrelationship of the players anyway.
Well, there's a danger about that theory. There's some truth in it, as I discovered in Greece. Mind you, I knew the words. But yes, you see, the whole thing, how a play is directed, whether the person who comes into the room comes in that way and goes close up to you, or whether they see every second is both physical and physicalized as well as imaginative in our language and so on. However, there's a bit of a trend, and sometimes directors who are not writers, but in a way want to be, decide there will be some ad lib. The actors will speak their own, you know, they'll all invent, they'll all come together. There's one director who does it very effectively, but it's with film, Mike Lee. He takes a sort of skeleton of a story and they build it between them. But it's different in film. I think in theatre, you need a great text and then make it greater by the imaginative inventiveness you put into it. But to have people, it's bunkum that you, I, and a few other people say eight characters in a play and we'll all trot out our lines because there's no spine to it. There's no overriding intelligence in that. And not just because I'm a writer, but as an audience, as a viewer, I feel strongly about that. It's a waste of time.
You have also written a biography of James Joyce, dear to your heart. Question for you then, what is the difference between a biographer writing a biography and a novelist writing a biography? Is there a difference?
I think there is probably. I think a biographer, or in the past anyhow, they take it from the grandfather was born in so-and-so, and they, you know, go through the life up to the birth of, say, James Joyce. And I loved Richard Ellman's, but he's a special case. I wanted, because I'm a fiction writer, to get, if I could, through his works and through his letters, into the spirit and, to some extent, thinking of James Joyce. I didn't give a damn where his grandfather or his grandmother was born. We have all that. I also wanted, as I would if I were reading a biography, to focus on the key things that were and will remain the foundation of his life. His mother, father, that's true for everyone, the country that he fled from, the woman that he fell in love with and was sexually besotted by, his writing, of course. But we take that for granted.
Right.
I mean, that, and that's there. And then this Lear, King Lear-like relationship with his mad daughter. And his own growing fear, he being blind and having to grope for the words with his fingers when he'd write it in thick crayon to feel the words, his growing fear that he was not creative anymore. And I found that to be, well, I found it heartbreaking. But I wanted to tell the story of James Joyce, but to emphasize or focus on the most important parts of it and the parts that formed him and the parts that make real story. When we began talking, you talked about conflict in my book, in Wild Decembers. And Joyce was of the opinion, which I also hold with, that conflict is the source and progenitor of all art. And very often for the writer, the conflict is in the life. It couldn't be in the writing if it wasn't in the life.
Do you think that his greatest work is Ulysses' portrait or Finnegan's Wake?
Well, I think Ulysses is just, as Ernest Hemingway so beautifully put it, he said, it's one hell of a book. There are wonderful things in Finnegan's Wake, the Anna Livia section, I think is one of the most beautiful pieces of prose ever written, and it's almost not as if it was written. Joyce himself said, I want water to sound like water and birds to chirrup like birds. He didn't want to describe things. He wanted to give them. That the words were them, rather than saying the bird sang sweetly or whatever. I like Portrait of the Artist and his short stories, but you see, Ulysses it's 18 chapters, and it's like 18 dazzling, brain-defying novels. It ranges from the scatological to the ecstatic, the sexual to the ruminative, the cerebral to the emotional. It's the whole caboodle.
I know we're going very far afield here, but I don't know how many times I have started Finnegan's Wake only to be so put off after 10, 15, 20 pages by the fact that I couldn't find a way to get into it. And the question to you, how do you get into Finnegan's Wake?
I think only Joyce got into it, to tell you the truth. A lot of people pretend they do, and they write these kind of little, you know, structural or destructural, I think they're called, and they analyze it. I think, he attempted the impossible. As I've said in my book on him, he tried to do what we do when we dream at night, and that is very inaccessible. The only thing I think probably about Finnegan's Wake is one doesn't need to read it all. One just now and then reads a paragraph, and it's very, it's so dense and so full of relation between one thing here and one thing there, and it's Joyce's mind. It's as if his skull opened and was tumbled out into those words. You couldn't read the whole thing, and certainly it could over a lifetime, maybe. But I feel that Ulysses was where he reached his ultimate. And having written Ulysses, what could he do after that? He had to do this impossible thing, to hack away at the granite of language and make so many puns, alliterations, alterations, that no one made the journey with him.
Edna O'Brien, you've now completed this trilogy. Have you begun thinking about your next work? Have you started?
This is the problem. I have not. I come to your lovely city, and I'm coming out here looking at the sea and over the bridge and all this, and I'm thinking, Edna, go home, find a story. But as yet, I don't have one. But maybe in 2 years or three, you might bring me back if I find a story. That's the bargain, the Faustian bargain.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Edna O'Brien continued to write novels and plays through until near the end. Her final novel, Girl, was published in 2019. I would interview Edna O'Brien again on December 8, 2003, while she was in the Bay Area premiering her play Triptych at the Magic Theater. That interview will be posted at a later date. You've been listening to an interview with the late Irish novelist and playwright Edna O'Brien, who died on July 27, 2024, at the age of 93. It was recorded April 28, 2000, while she was on tour for her novel, Wild Decembers. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.